Hello to all you wildlife warriors. It is time for another episode of the Conservationists Assembled podcast, where we team up with the Earth's mightiest defenders to learn about the diverse species and landscapes that make our planet so incredible. Today's episode is all about the Gordon's Wildcat, and we've got an extra special guest who's an expert on these little felines. Let's give a warm welcome to Dr. Alex Sliwa. Okay, so Alex, thank you for joining us on the podcast today. How are you?
Thank you, Johnny. No, I'm doing well. Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Yes, I'm very excited to discuss with you today about the Gordon's Wildcat specifically and your kind of expertise within both actually in situ and ex situ conservation as to try and link the two together and how they work. So firstly, then, can you tell us a little bit about the physiological and ecological traits of the Gordon's Wildcat?
Yes, no, it's a pleasure. So the Gordon's Wildcat, I think for an untrained viewer would look like a tabby house cat, you know. So it's quite a specialized view to distinguish a Gordon's Wildcat. It's essentially an Arabian wildcat. And taxonomically, it belongs to the recently split two species of wildcats. You know, the one is the forest wildcat, which is also the one that is in Scotland, you know, Scottish wildcat. And then the second one is the so-called African Asian wildcat. And the Gordon's wildcat is just a small population of this African Asian wildcat, but it's restricted to Oman, the Sultanate of Oman, and the United Arab Emirates. So in the essentially northeasternmost range of the African wildcat. And it's a pale, quite small desert version of this species or subspecies. So females are around 2.5 kilos and males 3.5 to 4 kilos. So a bit smaller than your average house cat. You know, definitely not a huge house cat like a Maine Coon or something, sure. But it's your normal short-haired house cat. And physiologically, you can say that, you know, African wildcat are a very tough and adaptable species. So they are able to survive under savanna conditions from 40 degrees plus up to minus 15. So it's but more restricted to the drier climates. Although there's some populations which are obviously in precipitation areas which are similar to where we live here in Europe. But this particular Gordon's wildcat is definitely adapted to very dry conditions. It lives in the deserts around the cities of Dubai, Sharjah, different emirates. And obviously the type specimen was described in 1968 only by Harrison. It came from Sohar, which is the north of the Sultanate of Oman. You could actually describe it as sort of a pale, small African wildcat, you know, very faint barring on the sides of the body. Characteristic of the African wildcat in general is it has rusty colored backs of the ears. There is no pure white. It has sort of an off-white underside and a bit of white on the nose, but there's actually no real white, which makes it the only way to really distinguish it from a hybridized or a domestic cat. Which have often white on their paws, on their faces, on the underside, or they're even piebald. And it's a remarkably tough species that can live almost as effectively as, let's say, the sand cat, which is a more even extremely adapted species to the desert conditions of this area. Yeah, that's about it. And obviously it survives with very low prey densities, but I think we'll get to that.
Yes, I'm sure. Yes. So then what are kind of classification wise and obviously then, you know, throughout its history of taxonomy, what are we kind of establishing the population trend and number and classification of the Gordon's Wildcat at the moment?
That's actually a big dilemma because it's difficult to, obviously the old taxonomy said it's a subspecies of Felis sylvestris, the wildcat at that time. And obviously in the last century, over the last century, a number of so-called subspecies were described from the Arabian Peninsula, including Tristrami and Iraqi and other ones. And the Gordon's wildcat has been separated just by size-wise and by its coloration. But obviously, this is phenotypic, so externally visible characteristics. It wasn't really manifested in bodily conditions, let's say. I mean, like there was no clear-cut difference to this other subspecies by, let's say, the skull measurements or bodily measurements. Although it is said that the auditory bullae, which are containing the inner ear of these cats, are exceptionally large, which is sort of it's similar to, let's say, the sand cat, which also works mostly to capture its prey by hearing. So this is an indication for cats that they can actually hear if they have exceptionally large auditory bullae.
Okay, so then we determine that their primary sense is by the size of the ear, and then maybe if they've sacrificed other senses, the features would be smaller.
Yes, of course. And obviously, like all cats, the Gordon's wildcat has exceptionally good vision. I mean, a very, very sharp vision, good night vision. That's generally for the holds true for all the felids, all the members of the cat family.
And then, with regards to night vision, are they primarily nocturnal or kind of crepuscular, or are they active in the day as well?
Yes, that's exactly the point. Obviously, a large part of the year, temperatures are very high in the desert areas. I mean, in this part of the range, it goes up to 50 degrees. And so it's very difficult to be active for a mammal in these kind of temperatures. And obviously, also the prey animals of these cats, which are ranging from insects, reptiles, depending on the year or of the time of the year. Rodents are probably the mainstay. And then also birds are available more easily for this cat. Definitely the rodents are outside of the burrow at that time. So the cat is actually adapting its activity pattern towards the activity pattern of its prey.
Okay, so then with obviously we're probably going to, well, we'll definitely discuss the major threat to this species, which is hybridization. With then climate change, and are we seeing an impact on climate change to their behavioral pattern, or kind of the window that they have for such activities as hunting, in this particular species?
It is obviously it's very difficult to prove in this subspecies because obviously if you want to prove climate change effects, you have to study a large number of individuals by telemetry, looking at their behavior, looking at their long-term development, survival, and so on. But it's highly likely that climate change, if that would include a rise in temperature and a drying out of the area, would affect the species a lot. By pushing it past the its ecological capabilities, because then actually the sand cats takes over. If it gets more hot and more dry, the wildcat is at its limits.
Right.
If it would get wetter, I mean, like I'm not an expert for the climate change predicted for this area. Get wetter, it will probably have an effect that these cats would maybe even get bigger and darker, depending on the amount of vegetation, and so on. But obviously, this region where these cats are, the Gordon's wildcat lives, is a highly favored area for human activity. So
Right.
obviously, you have the mega cities of Dubai and Sharjah, other Emirates. There's a huge amount of tourism development. Also, northern Oman is definitely in developing at this moment. So the impact of human beings on this desert environment is increasing.
Okay, so then let's discuss the main threat of GWC, which is hybridization. How does that begin? How do we combat that? And how can zoos maintain kind of genetic diversity?
Well, first of all, the Gordon's wildcat is essentially the wild one of the wild forms, essentially the wild form of our domesticated cat, which then in many cases goes feral because people don't care for it, you know, don't keep it in their home. These feral domestic cats are actually feeding off garbage, are close to the dumps, and they're usually also reservoirs of diseases. But the main threat is really that these cats, which are favored by human activities, I mean, these feral cats, are interbreeding with these Gordon's wildcat, with these wild forebearers. So the genetic integrity of this subspecies, of this population, is threatened increasingly. And actually, the zoos or the captive centers which are keeping Gordon's wildcats are, you know, they're trying to preserve the original of these cats by keeping a pure population of them for the future. And that is by maintaining them over long time periods, keeping some form of breeding going. Although I must admit, yeah, I've been looking after the stud book for now more than 25 years. The interest is very limited from zoos. It's not easy because this wildcat looks so similar to a tabby, and the general public doesn't see the point, you know, to preserve something that is not as exotic. Obviously, if you compete with whatever, a fishing cat or an ocelot or a sand cat, it's more difficult to get zoos and their visitors actually fired up for this species. But it fulfills a very important role by preserving the genetic integrity of such a population.
So then how many, because you say that there's not many zoos housing Gordon's wildcats, how many currently would you say are in Europe?
In Europe, that's only 22. I just had a look. We have an online tool where everybody enters their information. So it's less than a bit less than half of them are in Europe. The other half is actually in Oman and in the United Emirates. And the total population currently is 58 Gordon's wildcats. So the population is small, and also the founder base is very small. It's based on just 6 founders. And obviously it would be very beneficial to expand that, you know, to be able to include more wildcat founders after checking. Obviously, once you caught them, you need to genetically check them if there's any introgression of domestic or feral cats. But that's, as I said, it's a small population.
Hopefully we'll get some more people involved with it, and hopefully more collections will start realizing the importance of housing these species soon. So what role do Gordon's wildcats play within their wider ecosystem?
The Gordon's wildcat is one of the small predators which fulfills a critical function in the balance of an ecosystem by controlling rodent numbers, being a selecting agent for diversity. It's like every species on this earth, you know, has an ecological role, and obviously it has that effect. And also, I mean, it's not really a strong prey animal, you know, because they are in very low densities available, but still a desert environment being so low in biomass, it's definitely an important species on this respect.
And then with regards to conservation as a whole, what actions need to happen to help secure a future for this particular subspecies?
Unfortunately, this is quite an ambitious undertaking if we want to secure it. So we actually have to make sure the governments, the people of the two countries are aware of the plight of this subspecies. So it would actually mean that there has to be a control of the feral domestic cats by neutering those which are not being taken care of, which is highly difficult. I mean, this has been the problem in many regions of the world. I mean, in Southern Africa, for instance, you also have hybridized Southern African wildcat populations. The most famous is definitely the Scottish wildcat, where you have a lot of introgression. Almost actually, there's very few purebred left. And there's currently a breeding project and release project going on in Scotland, which I'm also advising to. So yes, it's there has to be an awareness in the United Arab Emirates and Oman. And once you can control, obviously, these feral cat populations, you would have then a breeding potential from those captive ones and releasing them and propagating them. I mean, maybe even some of the last pure Gordon's wildcat out there in the wild are able to rebound and to regain their habitat and maintain the perfect adaptation to this desert environment.
So then how can, you know, everyone get involved with the conservation? Because obviously it's for such a, you know, a small population and such a small region. What is something that the wider public can do to help get involved with this kind of conservation project?
Well, first of all, I think it's really important is the awareness, you know, to be aware that this is a native species. It's not a domestic one, you know, and it is of value, you know, it is rare. And being aware that there is a strong impact by humans and their domesticated animals or, you know, feral animals. So I think that's number one. And then obviously by this public awareness and pressure in generating funds or making sure, you know, this is recognized and there is more support for this captive population. I mean, what we would definitely need to release animals again is to expand the captive population. I mean, normally you would need at least 120, 200 animals as a breeding stock, you know, to generate enough animals for a release, you know, just as a sort of ballpark for a small cat. If you want to have a continued release over 5 to 10 years, you should release roughly between 10 and 20 animals per year. And to be able for a population to generate this, you need a large enough breeding pool. And for that, obviously, it would make the biggest sense actually to establish such a breeding center in the range country. So in one of the Emirates or in several Emirates and in the Sultanate of Oman. So I think the public has to be aware that this is one of their native wildcat species. And it's obviously a beautiful species. I mean, it's just that we are so used to domestic cats all around us. It's a very popular animal. And maybe they're not aware, you know, this is a wild species and it's worth the saving and worth our attention. And I think this would be definitely the focus. Obviously, if people are able to donate, or if schools are able to concentrate in teaching children and doing activities making even their parents, you know, children can bring it back to their parents aware that this is a native species and it needs the intention, it needs our intervention of, you know, deterioration of the environment and our impact.
I think that flows nicely into my next point then. Certainly we know that aside from having, you know, a stock or a population of animals that are genetically viable should something take a turn for the worst in these home ranges, zoos are incredibly important for funding and education. And it's not just because we want to do those things, but it's actually a legal requirement of certainly well-governed zoos to do those things. So what kind of research or resources does public and zoo funding contribute towards?
Well, zoos depends a lot, you know, on what, how do you define a zoo and where that zoo is located and the obviously the economical situation of that zoo. So let's say here in Germany, most zoos are city-owned or state-owned, so they're a large proportion of the funding for a zoo and maintaining the animals and everything comes from also from the public. So it is supported by the public, and only a smaller part is coming from the revenues from the zoo. So it's actually largely non-commercial. Obviously, those zoos need to look after their funds, but in general, the Gordon's wildcat is a very hardy species. It doesn't require a large amount of funds and keeping staff. I mean, it's not difficult to keep, and it's quite hardy. So luckily, it will not require a lot. Obviously, nowadays, which is good, a good exhibit should reflect the natural environment of a species. And obviously, in the past, we held small wildcats in very small and very environmentally impoverished enclosures. So those should be much better furnished, much more reflecting the natural habitat. And obviously, with this feeds in that education to the public. And I think it's a crucial role zoos and the public can play in pushing this Gordon's wildcat and making it aware. You know, this is the ancestor of our domestic cat, which is obviously domesticated in a crescent in a fertile crescent. So essentially in Iran, Iraq area, but that's not far from the Emirates or Oman. So we're not even nowadays 100% sure that all the domestic cats came from there. Maybe there have been several centers of domestication.
It's really interesting, and you have given us a really crucial insight as to how, you know, we've got to where we are with Gordon's wildcats and what we can do going forward. So now I'd like to focus on you for a little bit and talk to you about your career and in a sense of paying it forward. Obviously, it helps hopefully inspire the next wave of conservationists. So firstly, then, when did you or what drew you to working with Gordon's wildcats?
Well, this is a long question. This is quite a long thing. Question to me, you know, I would consider myself I'm a wildlife biologist by training, and my interest in cats and wildlife has been very long. You know, it's I think my parents told me I was interested from about 4 years old, 4 years of age, and the cats have always been my focus and interest. And particularly the older I got, and actually through zoos, my interest was stimulated by that. It really focused on the smaller wildcats, you know, not just tigers, lions, leopards, jaguars. And actually the first Gordon's wildcat I've been seeing at Wuppertal Zoo, and which is about 60 kilometers from Cologne Zoo, where I'm working currently, and where I was curator 16 years before I started working here. Generally, my interest, I came into the zoo world, in the professional zoo world, as a wildlife biologist. So I did my master's on birds in Jamaica, and I did my PhD on aardwolf, which is a hyena relative in South Africa. And my real passion then turned onto the black-footed cat, which is in the same habitat in South Africa, and which I've been working on 32 years in the wild and also in captivity. And obviously my interest has then diversified onto sand cats, which I'm also quite well known by now. And obviously also this desert adapted wildcat, which is the Gordon's wildcat, or you could call it the North African wildcat. Yes, and I must just say, I've been stubborn in pursuing my career. I've been trying to just hold on to my dream in researching these animals in the wild. And I had a long period of fasting. I didn't find a job easily. And but I thought, you know, I had this determination in holding on and writing and reading up, and then finally actually doing this research after people started believing that I can actually do it. So I owe this to the black-footed cat, which I was really pursuing really hard, and I could show people, you know, I would produce data, I would produce photographs, so I was producing reports. So these mostly NGOs and zoos started believing in my abilities, and I think I can only advise people who want to get into this. You have to pursue your dream, and it's a long stretch. It will take you a long time. You may be lucky, but yeah, it's economically quite tough. And to be just very, very honest, I had my first paid job with 34. So this is a very long stretch. But I can only encourage people. That's the only way to start, particularly on a less known, less sexy, if you would say like this, wildlife. Let's say elephant, gorillas, rhinos. It's the megafauna. You know, lions. Everybody wants to do research on. And I obviously, as a child, also thought, wow, tigers are fantastic. I still like tigers, but obviously, the small wildcats were really not. not taken care of enough. So I really focused on that, and I must say I'm very happy, and I'm by now quite well known for them.
Yeah, there's a reason why, like you say, those megafauna are still, talked about in everyday conservation. And yeah, it's incredibly crucial to try and get every species up to that standard. So yeah, I think it's great that you've dedicated your career to these smaller, less recognized species. Would you say there's one lesson that small cats have taught you?
I think incredible endurance. I'm over and again impressed how these cats survive, and sorry to say, I've seen a lot of them die. You know, it's not all positive. I mean, the living in the wild, although it's romanticized by people, particularly those who are living in cities and who don't know, what the hardship is, can be extremely tough. And just, that will to survive and to just make it. And it's not just food, getting enough food, but also surviving the onslaught of predators, which are after them and killing them. But also the massive human impact. It's really increasing. So we really have to be aware of it. And I'm over and again, fascinated how these animals should just survive. And obviously cats are famous for this, that with their 9 lives. I think it's the epitome, of survival. And I obviously enjoy cats a lot, and just reading their behavior, watching them. And luckily, all the three species I've worked on, the three species I've been able to watch directly. I don't have to, look at my laptop and look at the GPS locations of these animals. I actually get to see them and enjoy them. And yeah, so this is the lesson. It's essentially survival and wittiness to do this. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I've never really considered where the phrase 9 lives, originated from, but to hear you say about the resiliency, it's quite fitting, and I suppose something that, yeah, when we most often refer to 9 lives within domestic cats, but and in more of a light-hearted way, but I suppose, yeah, it does very much ring true for these wild species.
Yes.
So you've mentioned you're now curator at Cologne Zoo, and we know there's no such thing as a typical day within, conservation. But what does, for lack of a better word, a typical day look like for you?
So I'm responsible mostly for mammals here at the zoo. I have shifted quite a lot. I started as a primate curator, then had 15 different large enclosure building projects, so I had to learn a lot about building exhibits for animals. But my primary role in Europe for the European Associations of Zoos and Aquaria is that I'm the chair of the essentially cat specialist group. So it's called the Felid Taxon Advisory Group. So I'm essentially since 21 years overseeing all the cat breeding programs in this association, with more than 300 zoos being part of it. And that's scientifically led zoos. So I'm very concerned. I'm very much involved in breeding programs on tigers, Siberian and Sumatran, on Asiatic lions, on sand cat, on jaguars, on different leopard subspecies. So I do a lot of communication towards these programs. If there's any problem somewhere in Europe, with communication between holders and the coordinators who are coordinating these programs, I'm helping. But I'm also very involved in several reintroduction or breeding programs for reintroduction, starting from the Iberian lynx in 2004, Scottish wildcat, Persian leopard, and currently actually Eurasian lynx. So that's sort of my desk job, but I'm also involved, obviously, I'm responsible for an African riverine exhibit. So I deal with hippos and all the animals in this exhibit. And I'm also responsible for all the big cats and the bears and the whole South American section, starting from reptiles, amphibians, up to tapirs. So this is sort of my managerial work, looking after 30 keepers. I'm their direct boss. Conservation, I'm working on, particularly for the black-footed cat, which is really my focus, my personal focus, even before Zeus, but actually facilitated hugely by my connection with Zeus. Without that, I would have never been able to pursue this in this way. And Cologne Zoo grants me the opportunity to do some of that research and conservation in my working time. So whenever I go to South Africa or Namibia, the zoo is actually sending me as a work day if I'm out there in the field. So, and it entails a lot of communication with the people in the field, generating funds, writing newsletters, but I'm obviously also connecting. I'm a member of the IUCN Cat Specialist Group since 1995, so a long time. And actually, I'm very much in contact with the chairs of that Cat Specialist Group on anything that's sort of related with captive cats and the link to those in the wild. And we need increasingly more connection between those two, the wild and well-run zoos and zoos with a conservation mind. Obviously, there is zoos which are not very good. You know, they're mainly for display or amusement, but that's not what we definitely want in zoos. We have to have a conservation educational message as well. And not just a message, actually a true involvement. So that's my day. And it's every day is different. And obviously I'm often requested as a specialist, not just on cats. I'm also a specialist on elephant shrews, sengis. I'm a specialist on small deer. I have worked on the lion tail macaque for a long time. It's a primate from southern India. So yeah, it's my zoo career. I'm definitely a zoologist who enjoys all kinds of animals. And as I said, I did my master's on birds. I'm a professional ornithologist, but also a bird watcher. So I thoroughly enjoy wild animals, both in the wild and well-kept ones in captivity. Yeah, that's a short overview.
No, it's great. I could listen to you go on. And yeah, certainly quite an array of species under your belt, but also quite a range of duties within your career or over your career. So then going forward, what else would you like to achieve in your career?
I think I'm extremely happy with what I've achieved so far, and I obviously want to continue with the projects I'm involved with, and I'm to a certain degree also open for future more projects. You know, I just touched lightly on it. You know, there is large projects on African lions in particularly the northern African lions. I'm definitely open to anyone who's any people working in the wild on animals that want sort of this captive component and I'm always happy to make the connection to zoos and through the connection of zoos to the public and in funding, you know, generating funding for in situ projects. I think that's really important and that will stay with me even if I retire. You know, I will probably be considered and contacted by lots of different people, both in the zoo world but also in the wild. Luckily, I have a foot in both realms strongly through also publication and trying to make that link the whole time. So that's really my dream, to bring both closer. And actually, the opportunity of a good zoo to show an animal that in the wild would be very hard to observe, I think that's a unique opportunity. And good zoos obviously also have very good educational departments. They have a zoo school. So they run a lot of children through it, and it's really a good opportunity for children to actually see that animal, and it stirs a connection that is much stronger than through a film. Although, you know, some people who are zoo opponents don't think so; they think everything can be done virtually. But I definitely don't believe in it. It's a difference if you see and by yourself, you know, on your own time, how an animal behaves, how it smells, how it sounds. It's a major achievement and it's a formative process to be able to do this. Definitely for me, I grew up with zoos in different parts and that really formed my love for nature too. So that's one of the achievements I'm hoping to.
I think it's incredibly, you know, revitalizing to hear not just yourself but a lot of of keepers and people involved with zoos in this day and age to acknowledge that, you know, while there are a lot of conservation-minded zoos that, you know, we are not just educating the public, but we are also trying to educate those zoos that aren't quite up to standard to improve. We're not saying that they shouldn't exist, but we're saying that you know, there's certainly room to improve and that they are, you know, an incredibly important role within conservation and that they should be a mainstay, certainly while the, you know, the status of biodiversity globally is in the state that it is in, that, you know, we should continue what we're doing because it is incredibly important.
Yes, I totally agree.
So, knowing what you know now, when you were first looking to get involved in conservation, what advice would you give to yourself, or what advice would you give to someone who is just starting out their career within conservation?
That's a difficult one. I mean, obviously you have to be open. It's never enough to network. Obviously, when I didn't have a secure job, I was essentially in research and at the same time always in conservation. I had this great sense of insecurity, and I always wanted to, but it's important to meet people, to address people, to write emails, to go by, to make connections, to go to presentations. Anything that's not just virtual. It's the human factor is huge. That personal part is I can just stress, you know, people are, yeah, we are humans, so we are looking at not just images or written things. We are also connect through, yeah, body language and so on. And I think it helps. And my advice is really, yeah, try to connect. It's highly important. It's sometimes a bit difficult, obviously, because if you want to work on wild animals, you have this sort of image in your head, you know, I want to work in the wild, and I want to be, you know, out there. But I can just tell you, the human part is massive. You have to always deal with people. I mean, it's for permits, for research, for funding, to connect with people. It's really important. And I obviously I'm not the best person to give advice on that, because I really but yeah, in a way I was lucky, and yeah, I somehow pulled through, and it worked out, and you get better, obviously, you know. You overcome your shyness and your initial hesitations by also becoming more confident through your own work. So if you specialized in something, some point people want your advice, and people want your expertise, and that gives you more and more confidence, and by that you get obviously more connections. And the second thing is obviously staying with a subject. If you jump around all the time, and I think stability is important. You cannot expect to become an expert in 1 year. I mean, it will take many years, and on some subjects I still learn after 30 years on my subjects. It's a long process, and yeah, you have to have endurance and patience, and yeah, connections. That's what I say.
Perfect. I think that's, yeah, very very insightful into, you know, identifying that it can't be done just by one individual. There are plenty of knowledgeable people out there, and we should make most of one of the best resources that conservation has, and that is, you know, the knowledge of the people around us and the people that share the same passions as us. And so, Alex, that does give us a lovely, wonderful insight into your career. So we're just going to finish up the episode with some fun questions, just to have a bit of a light-hearted moment. Because conservation, like I say, is very taxing. It's something that you're never truly done with. So for a man that's been around the world and seen lots of species, you may have seen all of the species that you ever anticipated seeing. But are there any, you know, species that you'd absolutely love to see in the wild?
Yes, of course. There's a lot of very nice species I would love to see. Obviously, My favorite one would be cats, and I think I would love to see a marbled cat in the wild or a clouded leopard. And I've seen quite a lot of cat species, but those smaller Asiatic rainforest species are very hard to see. And I must admit, I have been often to the neotropical areas, and I've never seen a cat. I've never seen a cat in the New World. So, I mean, if this is the old term is still permissible. So I haven't seen a single cat species in North or South America. These are definitely top of my list, but I generally love all kinds of wildlife. I love birds, reptiles, mammals. There is so many I would like to see. But definitely if I would have the choice, I would go for the rare cat species, which are difficult to see.
And then moving on, it was kind of similar then. If you could live anywhere or spend an extended amount of time anywhere, is there a particular continent that's kind of stolen your heart?
I can definitely say that Southern Africa is my second home. So I'm German. I'm living in Germany, but definitely Southern Africa. I have spent a significant amount of my life there, and it's really my home. So it's my heart is there. So, but it's possible, and I will continue traveling there and staying there for many weeks a year. So that's definitely my plan. Yes.
Yeah, I think there's certainly a reason why tourism is very popular out in Africa with regards to the wildlife that's found there. So yeah, certainly I've never been. One day I'm sure I'll get out there. When you're not working, how do you keep busy? Obviously, again, like we've said, we do dedicate our lives to conservation, but it's important to have something to take your mind off of it. So how do you keep busy when you're not working with animals?
I mean, my big hobby is obviously photography. I have started when I was 11 with photography and bird watching. So for wildlife photography, nature photography is my favorite, and I spend a big amount of my time on it. And first of all, doing all my travels, and then the processing of the pictures, and actually disseminating it to a degree. And obviously, social media is now the way. I have two social media sites, obviously mine, Alexander Sliva, and the second one is Blackfooted Cat Life, it's called. And I'm posting every 4 days something on it. And I'm trying to always select a nice picture and then obviously write an informative short text with it. So the public and more people subscribing are getting an insight. And that obviously came from my children. I have three girls in their 20s, and they have encouraged me to do this because they say this is the future. This is the future of influencing future conservationist people, getting them fired up for the nature. So that's a big part of my life. And then obviously just staying fit, because I want to stay fit. I'm not a fitness nut, but I'm in pretty good shape. So working out a bit, walking at least an hour and a half today, every day, just to, just to clear my mind, just to keep the body working, because I still want to do field work, hopefully into my 70s. That's essentially it. And obviously sometimes I switch off, just watching a nature documentary or reading a book. But that's actually quite rare. So I'm mostly active in my private time.
Fantastic, and thank you for providing the names of your Instagram pages. Certainly, we'll be directing our listeners to see how they can connect with you online. So, last question then: what is one thing that you think our listeners should take away from today's episode?
I hope that they become interested in the small wildcats. I think that's really worthwhile. They're fantastic. They're beautiful, interesting. There's so many facts to learn. I'm really hoping that they will look into this, and I'm happy to provide contacts and or links to that. That's essentially what I really would love is and that's my mission, I could say. And that's not just the zoo, but it's also my private, and everything that I do is towards the small wildcats. But generally, I'm just hoping that people are aware, about the fantastic variety and beauty of nature and their creatures. It's we are also part of it, and I really hope that they will take away this from this today's podcast.
I certainly hope so too. Alex, thank you so much for your time. It's been incredibly insightful, and yes, I think you've done a fantastic job of highlighting that when we think about felines, there's certainly a large overlooked community of species that we really could be doing a lot more for. And so hopefully we'll get a few more people involved, and certainly I know from the podcast sake, we'll be continuing to monitor what's going on in the world of small cats. So again, thank you for your time.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you, Johnny. I really enjoyed talking to you, discussing with you. Great. Thank you.
Well, folks, that's a wrap on another exhilarating episode of the Conservationist Assembly podcast. Dr. Alex served up some serious wisdom that I hope has left you feeling inspired. If you do feel this way, then don't be shy. Show some love for this podcast and Alex's work by giving them a follow on Instagram and spreading the word. And hey, if you're feeling extra generous, drop a rating and share it with your favourite people. This way we can keep the good work going and bring you more epic conservation heroes. So a big thank you for tuning in, and don't forget to catch us next time for another awesome wildlife adventure.